and I hope that your Pesach was safe and healthy and beautiful and inspiring and some combination thereof, but emphasis on the safe and healthy, please. And for those who have not yet been vaccinated, like myself, there's hope. Really, it's coming eventually.
Why weren't you vaccinated? They get to rabbis now.
So they do, but I feel like that's really meant for people who are seeing congregants, you know, not for somebody who sees congregants over Zoom, so to speak. I actually might qualify anyway. I just got an email 5 minutes ago about the possibility of vaccination for teachers, and since I teach in a school, I may qualify under that. We'll see. In any case,
Can I just say one thing, please, because I don't think a lot of people got it. I got it from Sunnybrook, but if you have a stem cell transplant or cancers, you are, by the Ontario government, you can get the second shot.
That's good to know. Okay, thank you.
Well, it didn't come to everybody, so I wanted
to. Got it. All right, no, that's very important to know. Thank you. Okay, so we are on week 3 of Megillat Rut. We spent 2 weeks before Pesach of introduction. And I actually just got an email yesterday asking me if I would write for the Shavuot to go for YU. So I responded to them saying, sure, if I can do an overview of Megillat Rut, I'll be happy to do that. But now we have to launch into the book itself. So once again, I want to thank Dana and Ilan Rubinstein for dedicating the series, as well as Mikorot for enabling this the series in Shari Shamayim. I do hope that one day this will be back in person at Shari Shamayim. And here we go. If you take a look on the sheet that I sent out, you see at the top the outline of Perek Aleph, the outline of Chapter 1. The story is hopefully familiar. The family of Naomi and Elimelech and Mahlon and Kilion move to Moab at a time of famine. Elimelech dies. The two sons, Mahlon and Kilion, marry Moabite women and stay for 10 years, and then they die. But the two women who they marry, Ruth and Orpah, are now gained by the family. Naomi hears that that the famine has ended in Israel. Hashem has remembered his nation. We're going to come back to that phrase. And she says, time to go home. However, she says to Ruth and Orpah, you stay here. There's no point in you coming back with me. I can't give you a husband. Orpah indeed leaves, but Ruth stays with Naomi with her very dramatic insistence, your nation is my nation, your God is my God, and so on. We have to spend some time talking about that too. And Naomi and Ruth return to Beit Lechem. That's our basic storyline. The themes in this chapter, very much loyalty and betrayal, like I talked about for the book as a whole. Loyalty and betrayal of other human beings, loyalty and betrayal of God, God's loyalty as well. And some of the questions I want to address, and by no means are we hitting all of them today, but some of the questions I want to address in this chapter include, why did Elimelech and Naomi leave Israel in the first place? What was their motivation in leaving? Did they really name their children Mahlon and Kilion? Right? What does Mahlon mean?
Sickness.
Sorry, louder?
Sickness.
Sickness, illness, right. So naming one's children illness is generally a bad idea. Hannah's shaking her head no. Hang in there, Hannah. We're going to come back to the names. Don't worry. So we will have room to discuss more. What would Kilion mean on the face of it?
End.
Sorry? End, right. Vayechulu, Hashamayim v'haretz, and various other uses of the term. Kilion sounds like ending, destruction. Naming one's children disease and destruction may have some impact on future therapy for them. It's a very odd decision, and we're going to have to ask what that's about. How do we view Orpah's actions when she leaves Ruth? What's that? Do we view that as bad? Do we view that as logical? How do we understand her decision to do so? And when you talk about Ruth's decision to stay with Naomi, is that driven by loyalty to Naomi, or is that driven by a desire to become a Jew? What exactly is that? So those are some of the questions that I want to look at in the course of this chapter. Undoubtedly, more questions will come up, but we're going to spend a lot of time on this perek. So first of all, just a brief note regarding the famine itself. As I said, we've talked about betrayal and loyalty. Would we view the famine as an example of divine betrayal? God has betrayed the Jews by creating a famine in the land of Israel. What would you say? Susan, shaking her head.
It has been said by Yaakov because he went to Egypt when there was a famine.
Oh, my question is not about Elimelech's family and what they did yet. We're going to come to that. My question, if God creates a famine, if God creates a shortage of food, should that be viewed as an act of betrayal? He is betraying us.
Betrayal by who? God?
By God, yeah.
But why would an act of famine have to necessarily be an act of betrayal? Could it? I mean, there's such a thing as nature.
Mm.
I mean, we can't totally disregard free will and nature. I mean, God, if something's just happened, and if... I mean, then if we're saying everything happens because God causes it, then we're taking away even nature being, the thought of nature being free.
So nature has no promise of free will.
No.
Human beings do.
Yes, but I mean, just the thought that it's, don't things just happen sometimes?
So,
So
Susan floats the idea, hang on. I see Susan B., but right now I'm on Susan P. Susan P. says that it is indeed possible that something simply happens. We have such ideas. The Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, speaks of that possibility. Sometimes things happen, and maybe it's not. It's simply the environment in which we live, as opposed to a divine message or reaction. Moish had his hand up. Susan B. also wants to say something, and I see a few other people also itching to talk about this. So Moish put up his hand. So I'm going to take Moish's hand, and then Susan, after that, it'll be your turn. Yes, Moish.
I think that you've made a very good point. I think it wasn't just me. I think God's famine was not just betrayal. It was the ultimate act of betrayal. And it was what drove Elimelech had his family away. And just to add something that is so literary, it can't be avoided. Because Elimelech is Vayelech. It's precisely the opposite of Abraham's Vayelech. Or Lech Lecha. And I think that's, from a literary point of view, it's just open to that interpretation, and it's just not a matter of literary, but social.
So Moish floats the idea that it is indeed a divine betrayal, and that when Elimelech is traveling, it's the opposite. Abraham, Lech Lecha, goes to Israel at the divine command, an act of faith, and that Elimelech, in leaving, is saying God has betrayed us. So he is willing to take up the view that this is a betrayal. Susan Brandes, go ahead.
Well, I think it's absolutely not a betrayal.
Yeah.
Because we've just finished a holiday where we were told mahatchala that there was going to be a famine, we were going to go down to Egypt, we were going to be slaves there, and then we would be redeemed.
So,
and
yeah,
this
sorry.
Is another similar kind of famine.
So there's no famine in well, there is, I guess. When God says it to Abraham, he doesn't mention the famine. He just says they're going to be strangers, but it is triggered by the famine in the land at that point. But actually, in my notes, that which you took as a given, I put in as a question, which is, we talk about God saving us by taking us out of Egypt. Well, what about the fact that God sent us there in the first place?
Right.
So, I think it's an interesting question. Sandra, you were going to say?
If you look at it that way, then were we not saved during the Holocaust?
So Sandra points out the inevitable end of all such questions, which is, then what about the Holocaust? And the Holocaust is different from a famine in the sense that it involves human actions, as opposed to a famine in the days before climate change, when you would just say, well, this is, you know, a natural event or a divine event, is looked at differently. Nonetheless, yes, inevitably, if we're going to question and challenge why did God do or why did God allow, we always will end up at the Holocaust as our final stop on the tour, at which I will say, as always, I have not the slightest clue. But what I want to highlight by exploring this is that the text itself and the comments of Chazal, of our sages, make clear that we do not view the famine as divine betrayal, but rather as something that the people in the story caused via their own betrayal. Take a look at chapter 1, sentence 6. Chapter 1, sentence 6 describes the end of the famine. And in it, we're told, Naomi got up with her daughters-in-law and came back from the fields of Moab, because when she was in the fields of Moab, she heard, Kifakad Hashem es amo laseis lahem lachem. God remembered his nation to give them bread. So the end of the famine is an act of divine loyalty to his nation, whereas the famine itself was just Vayihi Ra'av Ba'aretz. There was a famine in the land, which leaves it open for Susan, the first Susan's explanation, which is that it was natural, it just was, or the view that no, it actually was, the famine was a punishment. Take a look at source number 1 on your sheet. The Medrash in Ruth Rabbah, Petichta 3. Just to explain what a petichta is, because not everybody will be familiar. The Medrash is generally composed of comments that are associated with verses within the book, chapter by chapter. But the opening section of this book of Medrash, Ruth Rabbah, as well as some other Midrashim on books in Tanakh, begins with what's called a p'tichta, an opening, with the lessons that sages gave when they started to teach, when they began teaching this book. And this is one of them. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Banai Sarvanin Hain, my children are stubborn. You think? L'chalosan i'efshar, God says, I can't destroy them. I can't return them to Egypt, right? You know what the sign says in the stores, right? No returns on Passover items. So God says, I can't return them to Egypt. I can't trade them in for another nation either. But what am I going to do with them? I will cause them to suffer. I will refine them with hunger. Bimei Shefot HaShoftim, in the days of the judging of the judges. In other words, we have already seen the comment that the days of the judging of the judges indicates that there is something wrong going on, that the Jews themselves are acting in an inappropriate way, that the judges are not worthy, that the people are not worthy. That's part of an explanation for why the famine took place. The famine was an act of punishment, not being viewed as a natural consequence, not being viewed as a natural event, but rather being viewed as the people did something wrong, God took away their food for them to learn, and then, apparently, something went right, because God decided to send them food again. We don't know what they're doing right, we just know that God said, okay, change of course. Yes, Susan.
I just don't understand the phrase, refine them with hunger. I just don't understand what it
means. So the term in the Hebrew is a term that's very hard to translate, and I've translated it in different ways at different times. The Hebrew term is litzaref, mitzarfan b'yisurin. Litzaref is not just refining. It's the way that you refine metal. And what you do as part of refining metal is really smelting. At one point, I would translate litzarfan in sources on source sheets as to smelt them. But smelting is a weird word. It's a fish. And it just confused people more. And then I thought I would put in temper them, but it's not really tempering. Tempering is a different phase in hardening the metal. But what's involved is exposing the metal to extreme heat as part of the refinement and purification process of the metal. You come out stronger. Sorry?
So for humans to say that that'll make us stronger, that hunger?
We will come out stronger and more purified.
I think pure purify is better than refine in this case. I always find, for example, for Courant Marcel.
Yeah. Could be. Debbie, you were going to say?
I was going to say that. I was going to say purify. It sounds like trial by fire, kind of.
Yeah,
that's a Christian analogy.
It's not trial by fire. Trial by fire is different. Trial by fire is where you need to ascertain is someone guilty or not. God has already said, no, they're guilty.
It doesn't sound like a very Jewish concept to me.
Okay.
It sounds to me much more Christian, where, you know, you admit that you're a sinner and you sink to the lowest and then the priest says it's going to be okay. It doesn't sound very Jewish to me. Sounds like the opposite end.
So I'll tell you something. You know, we've said this before in other contexts, that most of what Christianity has is just another version of something they found in Judaism, which they may have taken to an extreme or warped in some way. So the fact that you find an idea in Christian thought does not mean that, you know, that it's entirely foreign. But more to the point, in Tanakh itself, we find the idea that people experience something that is meant to toughen them or is meant to purify them. And I'm going to put in a plug now. I might send a flyer later in the week. But we have a program on Sunday morning. My Beit Midrash has a program this coming Sunday morning in advance of Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. There's a passage in the Talmud which talks about three things that are acquired via Yisurin, via suffering. And one of them is the land of Israel. And our program is going to be Rabbi Moshe Aberman from Israel and Rabbi Sammy Bergman from my Beit Midrash speaking about what that means, the idea that Israel is acquired via suffering. But there absolutely is such an idea. You can't really get away from that. So, okay, that was a minor note. I just wanted to spend a little bit of time on that. I wanted to spend more time, really the whole rest of our time today and well into next week, on the question of what were the sins of Elimelech's family? What did they do wrong? And this question is important in at least two ways. Number one, to understand the messages that the story wants to tell us. And number two, to understand how we are meant to view the figures in the story, and Naomi in particular. Are these good people? Are these bad people? How are we supposed to view them? It is clear from the text itself that the story believes they've done something wrong. Can you show me that in the text? That the story believes they've done something wrong? Well, for starters, look at the structure in the beginning. The way that it's presented is there was a famine. Man from Beit Lechem goes to live in Moab along with his wife and his two sons, and then we get their names. And then in sentence three, immediately, and Elimelech died, and Naomi remains with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women, Arpa and Ruth, and they stayed there for 10 years, and then they die as well, and now it's just her. Even though 10 years elapse in the course of the story, it's presented in such a way that it sounds like action punishment. Action punishment. You left Israel, Elimelech died. You married Moabite women, and then the sons died. And frankly, Naomi says so herself. If you take a look at sentence 13, when Naomi is speaking with Ruth and Arpa, she says to them, I'm not going to produce more husbands for you. So she says, look at the end of the sentence. She says, this is very bitter for me. I'm going to leave out the word mikem right now because that's a word that I need to come back to. But this is very bitter for me, for the hand of God has come out against me. God has done this to me, and it doesn't sound to me like she's complaining. It sounds to me like she is saying, I'm being punished. And if you jump ahead to sentences 20 and 21, you see it once again. When she arrives back in Beit Lechem, and everybody says, whoa, can you believe what happened to Naomi? She says, don't call me Naomi, which is a term that we've explained means pleasantness, Naim. Don't call me Naomi. Instead, call me Mara, the bitter one. Why? Because God has been very bitter to me. I left here full, and God brought me back empty. So why would you call me Naomi? God has anavi. We'll have to come back to that, what anavi means. But God has testified against me, or God has oppressed me. God has done bad things to me. I am in pain from God. It's a framing of the experience of Naomi that she is experiencing punishment from God. You follow? I have seen those who argue that Naomi is actually complaining here, but that's not the vibe that I get. That's not what I see. Yael Ziegler, in her essay Mishpachto Shel Elimelech, makes an interesting point. I'm not really sure I agree, but I find it interesting, and so I bring it here as well. You know how the Megillah ends, right? What happens at the end of the Megillah? Chana, you're muted.
We get to David HaMelech.
We get to David HaMelech, right? We get a family tree, right? We're told about the descendants of Yehuda going down to King David. So she makes a very interesting point in number 3. She says, "Bisiyum haMegillah," at the end of the book, "Anu nitkalim b'mesha asui hayaliot ha'et hamishpachti shel Elimelech." We encounter what should have been the family tree of Elimelech. Eidut l'shushelt hayotzeit min haklal shelo, testimony to the chain which descends from his family. Imzod Elimelech klal lo mofia ba, but Elimelech's name doesn't show up in that family tree. Hu huchlav, he is replaced. Al yedei karov mishpachto hanadiv haraui boaz, he is replaced by the generous and more worthy Boaz. Elimelech lo zachal ilan yuchsin mishal atzmo mikevan shu ibeded zechuto liot chelek mimenu. Elimelech lost the right to be part of the family tree by sinning, and now he is out of the picture. I'm not really sure.
It's not part of Elimelech's lineage.
Right. Well, her point is that it should have been.
Was Elimelech's sin that he left Canaan?
So we're going to talk about that as a possibility. It's no longer Canaan at this point. It's already been Eretz Yisrael for a while. But that's certainly the only thing we can really blame him for. The only question is, what's wrong with leaving Israel in a time of a famine? We have a tradition of doing that. So we have to talk about that. But that's... Sorry, Susan, what?
My interpretation says that it's because he didn't...
Oh, hang on. I'm not ready for interpretations yet.
Okay.
I thought she was making an interesting point. More fundamentally, take a look at source number 4, which again we've seen already many times. Vayihi bimei shfoda shoftim, says the Gemara in Bava Basra. What does it mean? Vayihi bimei shfoda shoftim. It was in the days of the judging of the judges. Dor sheshofet es shoftav, a generation that judged its judges, which could mean the generation is bad, they're unjudgeable. When you rebuke them, they don't listen. Or it could also mean the judges are bad and worthy of being judged. They've got issues. So that, the Gemara continues, Omer lo tolkise mi bein shinecha, if the judge were to say to somebody, take that splinter from between your teeth, Omer lo tol kari beinecha, the person he was talking to would reply, take the board from between your eyes. Who are you to criticize me for flaws that you have in a much greater way in you? That's the Gemara in Bava Basra. Parenthetically, for those who are familiar with Matthew chapter 7, you will find the Christians make good use. You talk about things that Jews had that Christians adopted. You can also find that one in Matthew chapter 7, more or less. More or less word for word. But the Malbim says the message of the Gemara is to say that people are doing things wrong at this stage. That's what leads to the famine. That's what brings us into the story. But it doesn't tell me what did Elimelech's family do wrong. What was the sin? So our first option, if you take a look on your sheet, it's a heading. Option one, leaving the land of Israel unjustifiably. Now, the text can be read to support this. First of all, for the fact that it says they left Israel and Elimelech died. Right? And it sounds like it's immediate, because then we're told there's 10 years that elapsed after that. So it sounds like they left and Elimelech immediately died. And again, Naomi presents her bereavement as divine punishment, not just the loss of her sons, but also the loss of her husband, the loss of Elimelech. So the Gemara takes this approach. The Gemara, it's also a Tosefta. If you take a look at source number 6, look at this. Tanu Rabbanan, our sages taught, Ein yotzein me'aretz l'chutza la'aretz ela im kein amdu sasayim b'sela. You don't leave Israel to go outside of Israel unless the famine gets so bad that 2 measures of grain cost a sela coin. Is everyone able to follow me? Because I see that my screen has slowed down. Are we still okay? Okay. Let me know if the sound is disrupted. So the Brisa says, the Gemara quotes it, that you can only leave Israel if prices for grain get so bad that 2 sa'a of grain cost a sela. Since we don't generally work with sa'a and sela units, it's hard to translate that into what things cost for us nowadays. A sa'a, I believe, is usually 2 shekel, if that gives you any indication of anything. I don't know why it would. A mikvah is 40 sa'a in volume at the minimum. But not the mikvah that people dip in. The bore that actually holds the rainwater is 40 sa'a. How much is 40 sa'a? So there are different measures that are given for liters and gallons and so on. I'm not getting into dry measures versus liquid measures, so really this is a useless exercise. But that's what the price is. But then the Gemara continues. Amar Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon says, not so fast. Amosai, when is it true that one will be justified in leaving if the prices go up like that? Bizman she'eno motzei likach. Only if you also can't find grain. You know, sometimes inflation, prices go up, commodity is there, I just can't afford it. This, you can only leave if the commodity is actually not there. If the commodity is there, then even if it's even worse, one sa'ah costs a sa'ah, you can't leave. V'chein haya Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai Omer, and now we get Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's comment. He says, Elimelech machlon v'kilyon gidolei hador hayu uparnasei hador hayu. He says, Elimelech machlon and kilyon were not nobodies. They were gidolei hador. Here I pause. The term gadol hador has changed over time. Today, people use the term Gadol Hador to mean the biggest Talmid Chacham, the biggest posig. That's not what it means in the Gemara. There's a Gemara in Pesachim that talks about coveted marriage partners, and it distinguishes between a Talmid Chacham and a Gadol Hador. The Gadol Hador is a person of chesed, a person of kindness, a person who performs great deeds. That's what we mean when we say Gadol Hador here. So he says, they were people of good deeds. They were Parnasei Hador. They were supporters of the generation. So why were they punished? Notice again, the assumption is it's a punishment. Because they left Israel They weren't supposed to leave during this famine, and they got zapped. Now, how do I know that they were leaders in the community? Ricky wants to know. We're coming back to it. I'm not there just yet. But you should be aware. The Rambam actually quotes this Gemara as halacha. In his Mishneh Torah, his work of law, I didn't bring it on the sheet. It's Hilchot Malachim, Laws of Kings, chapter 5, law number 9. He quotes this Gemara with the story of Elimelech, Mahlon, Kilion being punished for leaving Israel during a famine. He quotes it as halacha. We have considerable halachic literature regarding when you're allowed to leave Israel and what is considered just a justification for leaving. But now we have to ask the question, what's wrong with leaving Israel? Why should they have such a punishment for leaving the land of Israel? Yes, Susan.
Hi, Mark. How would they know? I don't recall They were told you can't leave unless
The Chumash itself says you're supposed to come in and settle the land. That's
right,
your job.
But the predecessors left at every famine. They also have that.
So that's a question I have to come back to. Hang in there. I'm getting to that question. We're not there yet.
I think it's because they could have helped other people. They must have had some grain, something stashed away in a bag.
So we're going to come back to that idea. We're just not there yet. Sorry?
Is it because they're a leader? Like,
so, again, hold the thought for a minute. Number one, though, in terms of your question of how do they know that they're not supposed to leave, we have the mitzvah of living in the land, and we also have, the sheer value of it, the mitzvot that you're able to perform in the land that you can't perform elsewhere. And above and beyond that, the spiritual benefit of it. I see your hand, Mosh. If you take a look at source number 7, I brought you the Gemara, which speaks of the value of living in the land of Israel. And I'm not going to go into it now. I brought it so that you'd have it. But you can read it for yourself. The very dramatic way the Gemara talks about the importance of living in the land of Israel and that that's critical to having a relationship with God. But what I wanted to go through instead was source number 8. This is a beautiful essay from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein called Diaspora Religious Zionism, Some Current Reflections. And he talks about his first visit to Israel in 1962. And it's just beautiful. He says, in the course of my initial visit to Israel during the summer of 1962, I went to visit Mori Varabi Rav Yitzchak Huttner Zatzal, who prior to his aliyah would spend the summers in Yerushalayim. After reproaching me gently for having left my wife in the United States, and he has the Yiddish challenge, it's like, Ksuba hasta geschrieben, right? Did you give her a ksuba? Did you write her a ksuba? He began to question me regarding my impressions, particularly about what had struck my notice especially. As at that stage, I had focused upon the Torah world in Israel, I noted a number of phenomena which had struck me favorably as compared to the American scene. Widespread popular Talmud Torah, right? A lot of Torah study around. The interaction of the Torah and general communities in the implementation of Choshen Mishpat, business law. I just lost my place. There it is. Every reply was rebutted with the comment that its subject could have been found in Eastern Europe as well, and so was neither endemic nor unique to Eretz Yisrael. When he sensed that I had exhausted my material, he pressed on, inquiring as to what indeed was special about my visit. And when it became clear that I could at best only respond feebly, the Rosh Yeshiva opened with a volley of sources and dicta, the description of Eretz Yisrael as Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Osah, a land that Hashem your God cares for, or as that to which Moshe and Aaron had been barred access, which was now open to us, all trumpeting forth the sacral, metaphysical, and historical uniqueness of the land, and all causing me to realize in a flash that I had missed the boat entirely. It's not about the technical aspects of the land. It's about the spiritual nature of living there, and you can't forego that. That's what the Gemara is talking about here. Now I'll ask the question. Moshe, I still see your hand. Hang in there. But I'll ask the question which others have already asked, which is, but Abraham left during a famine. Yaakov left, but God told him to, so that's cheating. But Abraham left right after Lech Lecha. He arrives in the land, and then we're told there's a famine, and he leaves. So I think the answer is what Susan said before. Or it was either Susan who said it or Ricky said it, which is that because they are leaders, and that's what the Gemara was emphasizing, they were Gedolei Hador and they were Parnasin, because they were in positions of leadership, they didn't have the right to leave at this point. Their departure has too great an impact on the people around them. And we're going to talk momentarily about the issue of their support for others financially. But aside from that, the captain doesn't get to leave the ship. And so they are punished, Davka, specifically because they were Gdolei Ador, because they were Parnasim, because they're leaders. They're not allowed to leave. Moish, you've been so patient.
Okay, I have 2 points. The first of them is that just because they're rabbis who are making these points of view doesn't mean that they have any knowledge from a socioeconomic political point of view, which this decision is. I mean, you can call it whatever you like, and the rabbis can call it whatever they like, and I'm not arguing with that. But that's not the way it's seen for everybody.
I don't understand what you mean.
You have rabbis deciding on socioeconomic, political points of view. That's what...
What do you mean by socioeconomic? That's where I'm missing you. What are you referring to?
Famine. Can I support the country the way I was supporting them before? Do I want to stick around famine? Do I want my kids to...
Are you suggesting that halakha should divorce itself from reality?
Well, of course, you know, I would say yes, just to have fun. But no, because halacha has its purpose and its point of view even then.
Halacha has to speak to reality, otherwise it's worthless.
Pardon me?
Halacha has to speak to reality or it is worthless. If halacha is simply a set hang on, this is a conversation.
Political points of view, it is only a partner. It speaks to it, but not for it. Okay? I just want to point one other thing. I'm sorry. I have to step away for a few minutes. I don't know where you're up to. But I think this is very important, because if you look right through the first 5 psukim, God's name does not even appear. God's name does not appear. Now, you may say, well, it doesn't appear at all. But in the 6th pasuk, it does appear.
Yeah.
And that's when she returns, because she heard Kipakad Hashem.
Yeah.
So this is actually Holocaust imagery. That's exactly what it is. God is bye-bye. Like God was during our Siddurim this year and last year.
Moish, I'm not going through your thing about the Seder and COVID. I'm just not. I'm sorry.
I'm not. Come on. You can't not argue. You can't argue.
You can unmute, Moish. Moish, you're muted. I don't hear you.
Fine, so take off the seder. Take off the
yes.
Seder, okay?
Okay.
The rabbis don't fly the planes down to Egypt in 1967, nor the yeshiva boys. Of course they're important. God forbid I would say no. But they don't fly the planes. They don't even put the gas.
So some of them did, and I'm not willing to judge a generation wasn't even there for. But I'm focusing on the story here. Your read of it, that the first part is that God has checked out, is at odds with Naomi's read. Naomi's read is different from yours. Go back to the parts from when you were out and hear that discussion. But in terms
of... You read it differently. God's name is not there.
I understand that, but Naomi thinks it is there.
But it's... Maish,
you and I are going to have to continue this one further later. But in terms of the story itself that's in front of us, I think that the Gemara itself making a statement of you can't leave unless the following circumstances pertain, I think is the way halacha works. Otherwise, it just becomes a set of nice ideas. You have to apply it to reality and give the circumstances in which it applies. They need to give a standard for that. Yes, Susan.
I'm not being argumentative. I'm just confused. These were the rabbis of the Babylonian era. This was the Talmud of the Babylonian house.
Which one are you talking about? Which are you talking about?
Saying the Talmud says that you can't leave Israel.
So no, these are Tanaim who live in Israel. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is living in Israel.
So the people who are saying it are living in Israel.
Oh yeah, absolutely so.
How do we explain how all of us, that it's okay for all of us now to be living out of Israel with this quote? How do we explain that it's okay?
So you're asking a legitimate question, which has a much, much longer answer than we're going to get into now, but I'll give you just a couple of notes. There are those who have explained it religiously to say God sent us into exile and that's what God wants and we're not supposed to come back until God chooses to bring us home. That's one school of thought. You have another school of thought that says that we are supposed to be coming back and there is a mitzvah to come back and that all of us are wrong for staying outside. We're absolutely wrong. Then you have a third school of thought, which points to the Gemara itself, which says there are cases in which one is justified in being outside of Israel, that the mitzvah of living in Israel is unclear in terms of its application at this moment in history for a variety of reasons that are way beyond the scope. But there are all sorts of views that deal with exactly the problem you're raising. It's not a trivial issue. It's a significant and substantive issue. So I'm going to say, if we're deciding that the sin is in fact leaving Israel, whose sin is it? Clearly, it's Elimelech's to start with, right? Because that's the way the text frames it. Is Elimelech is the one who takes his family outside of Israel. The Gemara linked it to Machlon and Kilion. The Gemara that we saw in source number 6 sounds like they are punished for leaving also, which is odd, because they live there for another 10 years before they die. So it sounds strange to say that that's going to be on their record as well. It sounds more like they're just the sons who left with Elimelech. We're going to come back to Mahlon and Kilion. But the key question to me is, what about Naomi? Is Naomi also wrong for leaving the land of Israel? So most assume that no, this is Elimelech's decision, and she is stuck with it. Rashi says this explicitly on sentence 3, and he says that's why Elimelech dies and Naomi doesn't die. It's not her sin, this was Elimelech's decision. The Malbim says, of course, look at it in the text. Take a look at source number 9, at the way Malbim reads it. He says, "Vegam b'nei beiso shel Elimelech lo yatzu beratzon." Elimelech's family did not leave willingly. Ki lo ratzu la'azov eretz chemda. They did not want to leave the desirable land. Rak hu v'ishtau shnei vanav. It's presented in the text as him, his wife, and two sons. But it was him. It's really his decision. Shehu hayah ikar bazeh. He was the essence. And they were forced to go along with him. It wasn't her decision. And in fact, as soon as she's able to come back to Israel, she hears that life is livable. She makes the journey, even though she has nothing, even though she's broke. So that's the normal view that we read here, is Naomi was just stuck.
But wasn't Naomi punished? She lost her husband and two sons.
Yes. So the second view here is that Naomi is indeed considered to be complicit in this. And as Joyce says, it's seen in the fact that she says, this happened to me. God is punishing me. Take a look at source number 10.
The sons could have gone back on their own. Once they were married, they were adults.
Yeah.
Decision.
Well, I'm not sure they could have gone back, because they have their own issue, which is that they've married Moabite women, which was a no-no. We're going to come back to that one. But take a look at source number 10, please. Medrash, in a word called Ruth Zuta. Zuta means small. It's a small body of Medrash on Megillat Ruth. I've seen it suggested that it was actually compiled earlier than Medrash Rabbah, but I'm not expert in the field of dating Midrashim. But take a look at source number 10. Vishema Ish Elimelech, the man's name was Elimelech, dot, dot, dot. Mara'a kasuv la'achriz alav ve'al ishto ve'al banav. Why did the text announce guilt, right? And he left, and they left on him and his wife and his kids. Lefisha yu me'akvin ze'ed ze' mitzarus ayin shaya bichulan. Each of them stopped the other from staying in Israel. It was a joint decision. Each of them wanted to go this medrash. They are all abandoning their neighbors. Going back to Dr. Ziegler, she also notes the medrash that I brought you in source number 11. It's a problematic medrash. Look at this medrash. B'machlon v'kilyon b'tchila mesu suseyem v'gamleyem v'chamorehem. Machlon and Kilyon, first their horses died, their camels died, their donkeys died, v'achkach mesu, and then each of them died. And the way that they get that is because the text says gam shnehem, also them, also suggests there were more deaths first. So first it's Vayamas Elimelech Ishnaami, Elimelech died, V'achach Mesu Shnei Banav, and then his two sons died. Vayamusu Gam Shnehem Machlon V'Kilyon, also the two of them, Machlon and Kilyon, died. V'achach Mesa He, and then she died. Which is odd, because Naomi doesn't die in our book. Right? This is problematic. Where did Naomi die? I mean, eventually she died. But it's not in our book. Nonetheless, Dr. Ziegler really likes this idea that Naomi is complicit and that she gets punished for it. She suggests also that when Naomi comes back to Beit Lechem, the locals are cold to her because they blame her. Although I think that the text doesn't really support that as much as she would like it to. But there is a view that suggests, like Naomi's own words say, that she is being punished, that she is part of what happened here. So, if you read it this way, hold on 1 minute, Susan. But thank you for raising your hand. If you read it this way, then it would make sense that we include Megillat Rut in Tanakh as a book promoting our return to Israel in the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. Remember, Tanakh is canonized early in the second temple period when they're trying to get the Jews to come out of Babylon to, Babylon slash Assyria slash Persia, to return to the land of Israel. So this book is now a book saying, hey, they left and they got in trouble, you should come back. The weakness in that is that the book doesn't spend a whole lot of time on that agenda. If that's really what you want to promote, like you should have spent more of the text, promoting Aliyah, and you don't really see it. Nonetheless, it's an idea. Yes, Susan?
My query is, the Jews left the two boys, 10 years, no children, which is very unusual. Is that also, not having children, and that means Naomi's deprived of grandchildren, of continuing at this point the name, is that a punishment? Because it's very unusual to be married 10 years without a reason. We talk about all the women who prayed to God when they...
So you're raising a very important point. And yes, we have texts, we have sources that talk about a 10-year gap specifically as being a sign that there won't be. Even though we know of cases where there are, nonetheless, a sign that there won't be children. This is pointed out originally with Abraham and Sarah, that after they have lived in the land for 10 years and they haven't had children, that's when Sarah tells Abraham he should marry Hagar.
Is it because they married Moabites, or is it
possibly? quite possibly because they married Moabites, or because, again, they're guilty of leaving the land.
But it is a punishment in Judaism.
It can be. I wouldn't say it is. I would say it can be. It isn't always viewed as a punishment.
No,
with Rivka, with Rachel, it's not viewed as a punishment.
No, I understand.
With Sarah, it's not viewed as a punishment. Yeah. Okay.
Very
so I want to start on the second explanation. Somebody sent me a message in the chat. In general, if people could ask me questions out loud instead of in the chat, it's better for me. But someone asked, did most of the community stay in Israel? And the answer is, we don't have any indication whatsoever from the text. And I have not seen Midrashim that comment on it either. The only ones we know about are, in fact, Elimelech and his family. So the second view, as I listed it on the sheet, is abandoning the nation. They're wrong because they abandoned the nation. And the classic source on this is in number 12, the Medrash in Rut Rabbah. Elimelech haya migdolei hador umefarneseiat hatzibur. Elimelech was among the giants of the generation, supporters of the community, like we said in the Gemara. The kevin shabo shnei ra'avon, when the years of famine came, Amar, he said, Achshav kol Yisrael misovavin al psachai. All the Jews are going to come around to my door. Zeba b'kupasov, zeba b'kfifo. This one's going to bring his tzugah box. This one's going to bring his basket. They're all going to come to my door. I don't want it. So Ma'asa, what did he do? Amar ubarach lo bipnehem. He got up and he fled. As the text says, he left Beit Lechem Yehuda. Now, I'm going to come back to how the Medrash draws this from the Pasuk. But that's, I think, the best known explanation for what their sin is they didn't want to support others. Similarly, the Gemara in Bava Basra, which we read part of before, which condemned them for leaving the land, take a look at source number 13, in which the Gemara can't believe that they would have left the land unless the famine were so bad that this was justified. The Gemara says, Chas v'shalom shafilu matzu subin lo yatsu. God forbid, even if they had found just subin, which is coarse bran, they would never have left Israel. Ve'alim ipnei ma ne'enshu. Then why were they punished? Shahaya lehen levakesh rachamim al doram v'lo bikshu. They should have davened for their generation, and they did not ask God on behalf of their generation. And they quote a non-literal read of a sentence in Yeshaya in Isaiah. Literally, the sentence in context is God saying, when the Jews cry out, let their groups of idols save them. It's a comment from God about Jews worshiping idols. However, in the way the Gemara reads it, is, as I put it here, when you cry out for your community will save you. If you don't call out for the community, then you'll be punished. So two different ways that they abandon the community. Either they don't want to support them, or they don't daven for them. Where does this come from in the text? How do I even know that they were leaders? How do I know they were Gedolei Hador and Parnasei Hador? So if we had more time, we would, I would do this more thoroughly, but we don't, so I'm going to do it less thoroughly. First of all, take a look at chapter 1, sentence 19. When Naomi comes back to town, and everybody is in shock, and they say, can this be Naomi? Their shock indicates that Naomi had been a woman of status beforehand, and that now she has come down in level. That is supported by sentence 21, when she says, when I left, I was full. God brought me back empty-handed. Granted, full could mean I had a full family, but Ibn Ezra says, full of children, yes, and full of assets. And now she doesn't have it. Ellen.
When you were saying about Elimelech being like a beer or a stature.
Yeah.
So it does start off saying, Vayelech a man.
Yeah.
Then he switches to Vishem Ha'ish Elimelech, which is more, you know, be one.
Yeah. So I hear that. You could definitely say that, that there's an indication from calling him the man that he's somebody of special standing. I think that does support it. I would also note, remember what happens in chapter 4. Right? What's the theme of chapter 4?
They took Moabite wives.
I'm sorry, what?
They took...
No, chapter 4, not sentence 4, chapter 4.
So Ruth has fields.
Yeah, there's a field there. Yeah. There's a field. Granted, I don't know what that meant in terms of liquid assets, but Elimelech had a field. So they certainly had some things. The Medrash in Rut Rabbah adds a note to it. If you go back to the beginning of the book, the very beginning of the book, they are introduced to us, hang on, in sentence two, the man's name is Elimelech, his wife's name is Naomi, they have two sons, Mahlon and Kilion, and they are Ephratim. Ephratim is an interesting word. They're not from Ephraim, they're from Yehuda. Beit Lechem, where they lived, is known as Ephrat. In Bereishit chapter 48, when Yaakov describes to Yosef about the burial of Rachel, right? So he associates Beit Lechem with Ephrat. However, take a look at the Medrash in source number 14. Medrash from Rut Rabbah. Ephratim, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Amar Paltona, palace dwellers. Rabbi Menachem Amar, Yugit, I'm going to mess up this word. Yugitustati, which are nobles. Obviously the EU beginning of it is good, but it's somebody with a good position, a noble. And then the Medrash goes on to provide other associations for Ephrati, to mean a person of standing. And keep in mind that in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, Elkanah and Hannah, their family are known as Ephratim, even though they are not from Ephraim, they're Levian, and they're not from Beit Lechem either. Ephratim is taken as a term of power. These are people who had wealth, they had status, and they left. Now, what this doesn't tell me yet is how I know that they left in order to abandon other people. Maybe they just left because they were broke now because of the famine or because they were hungry. You haven't yet proved that they left in order to abandon others. So I had hoped to get to that today, but clearly it ain't happening. It's 2:30 already. So we're going to start next time with how we know that they left to abandon others. We're then going to get into the discussion about Mahlon and Kilion marrying non-Jewish women / Moabite women, and we have to talk about that as well. So we have a lot to see in terms of what are the sins of this, of this family of Elimelech and Naomi. Chana, you were going to say? No? Okay. So God willing, next week we will come back. To this. It's great to see you all, and look forward to going through more of the Megillah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Be well.